I'd like to saunter through the pictures with you one more time. And in particular, there are a few strands that I would like to pick up because I think they are important strands in our practice. I haven't done this before. It just kind of hit me as we were sitting there. So I'll try to be clear and direct. So the strands that I noticed going through are related to ones I brought in, I think, on the first night. That as we travel along, a couple of things are happening in tandem in our lives. We might think we're making them happen, but in any case, we kind of can notice them happening. And one is that something very fundamental about the nature of being itself, the nature of this itself, which we can't not know, but because we're made of it, but which we can forget about and kind of obscure to our detriment and everybody else's, shows itself in different ways to us, and we can find it in different ways. And so that's, you know, what we call essential nature or Buddha nature, yeah? The way things fundamentally are, and we talk about that a lot, unbreakable and unidentifiable, ungraspable tissue of presence and absence that we and everything else are made of. And that shows up everywhere all the time, that thing we can't fall out of, but that we can and perhaps must, as I was saying earlier, by nature of being beings, of being humans, of having the kind of consciousness that we have, that we must forget and find again, forget and find again, forget and find again. As we explore the territory of having bodies, of being bodies in a body, in an embodied world, in a world that has not only the ongoing phenomenon of not only a wave nature but a particle nature, yeah? And so we too have a wave nature and a particle nature, and in order to come home fully to that and be as generously present in this world as we would like to be, since we seem to be born with that yearning, we have to in some way have those strands interwoven in our lives, right? Because that's just the nature of reality and the nature of us. So it's not that, as I see it, some tragic flaw in us that makes us bad little people forget. It's that it's built in for us to forget and get lost and found and lost and found and lost and found. So this story seemed very much to me to partake of that. And you can see it through several different lenses. So one I called intimacy and skillfulness. So in our story, we can watch the development of intimacy and skillfulness together. And then, and notice that they're not separate. And we can watch the development of wisdom and compassion together. and of seeing and doing together, and of a kind of inward looking and outward looking together, which is expressed in the story, I think, by there's in each picture, there's something about the person and there's something about the territory. Each picture includes both us, the girl or boy, and the landscape. And they're equal weight, actually, if you look at it, right? It's not that there's a person against the landscape, the person and landscape together. And that's another level of intimacy that goes on. So let's just sort of look at the pictures from those, through those lenses, if you will, for a little while. And I'm going to bring in a little bit of sort of the traditional stuff, well, other commentaries too. So the search for the ox. I'm sort of, I think I really prefer ox because bull seems male to me, and ox is genderqueer. So sorry about these captions that insist on bull, because, you know, half of us are not that. So anyway, you know, and it may not seem to matter if you're not a girl. If you are a girl, it does.
I found myself rewriting some of these using my gender.
Yeah, yeah.
Because then it spoke to me more directly.
Because it feels more like it's about you. There's just not a way of getting around that. We are embodied in that way. Anyway.
You can call it a mirror. I don't care.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons that I think that song is so much fun. And having it sung by both Leonard Cohen and Andrew Harris is fun. But anyway, there is a little bit of a translation project involved for some of us. So anyway, the search for the ox. And we do search. And so in this first picture, you know, our search and our lostness are both fine. You know, they're both perfect. To be perfectly lost is just how it is sometimes, and necessary. Because if we don't be lost, we cannot... we can't notice that we've made a separation, right? And again and again and again, we do make separation, and I think it's sort of made out of us.
And I love the line in the song, the panic of loss.
Yeah. Really. Would you do something about the door? Thank you. And so also this sense of something lacking also means that there's an interruption in your usual story. Mm-hmm. Right? And if we don't interrupt our usual story, we barrel on with it. And our usual story is never complete, as we know. We're projecting all the time. And so, if we look at the Lankavatara, you know, our vow is to continually release the habit mind of continual projection, of beginningless projection, right? And so this sense of something lacking is maybe has something to do with that. And then the landscape, of course, you know, you're in the tall weeds, you're in the and it's getting dark and you're exhausted in the forest at night. And the cicadas, the crickets. Who have you got for company? Crickets. I love that right now that crickets hasn't that overtone, right? And it really does fit what they're doing here, you know, only crickets. But on the other hand, crickets, and so in the landscape, crickets, for any of you who've spent much time in the South, they are everywhere. They're directionless. You're not going to say, oh, I'll go in the direction of the crickets. right? So they too are the lostness in that way.
Yeah. And the sound has no direction to it if you sit and try and parse out where that cricket.
Right. It's like, oh, those two are clearly courting, right? No, not going to happen. So it's not like our wonderful winter owls who are courting right now. You can listen to their conversations. So there's that sense of just the bleh. Okay. And so there also is useful sometimes to think about, so what's the practice here? Right? What's the practice of being lost? What's the practice of feeling no intimacy? There's no real relationship in that first picture, right? You're pretty much on your own, cut off, and wishing. And yet there is both a seeing and a doing. There's a, I can't see anything. I can't see where I am. I can't find my ox or my mare, whoever it is. And yet I'm still here going. I'm just going. You know, like those times when you're just going. And and so there is a kind of inward and outward gaze, but both of them are kind of blocked, don't you think? You're in the woods, you can't see much, you can't see a direction, and you can't see much inside either. It's confusion in there.
And he seems to be walking in one direction, but searching someplace else.
Right, you're not even following your nose. Okay. Yeah. And, yeah, and what was that other expression about being lost? It's not.
To me, he looks like he might have heard something there.
What?
To me, he looked like he might have heard something.
Yeah, he's hearing crickets. Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay.
Maybe there's a hint.
Maybe there's a hint. Well, there isn't there always. It's always there, right? And
but this has got his attention.
Uh-huh, something's got his attention. Okay. So going on to the next one. You know, there are footprints. There are lots of footprints, right? Especially if you're down by the water. There are going to be lots of footprints. And so beginning to notice the holes in the confusion, noticing the spaces between the painful thoughts. There's also a little bit more space in that picture even, right? Mm-hmm. You're not completely closed in by the forest. There's a clearing. And in the clearing, under the river, along the riverbank, under the trees, footprints. And and again, there's this context, right? Deep in remote mountains. But they can't be hidden by the river under the trees. And so here is that glimmer of hope of relationship. Yeah? And a river is a direction. You're not in a directionless spot anymore in your landscape. And your nose looking heavenward, you know, there's a direction of gaze there too. So there's direction in a number of ways. And, and so what about the practice? Oh, so in the first place, what's the practice? You know, And there's maybe sort of, Steve, what you were bringing in. You know, what's the practice? You keep listening, mm-hmm. right? It's dark, you can't see anything, and maybe you only hear crickets, but you keep listening. And you just be lost. Yeah? And feel the panic. Yeah? And acknowledge it. And this is where, and without, one of the comments that I found said, pointed out, unless you go there a lot of times, you haven't yet begun. Right? And the Buddha said, until you come face to face with your own suffering, you haven't begun. And so this is not a not yet begun place. This is how you begin place again and again.
I'm also struck by how often the senses come in. You know, not just seeing or hearing, but now, you know, once you crush the grass along the riverside, it lets out this fragrance, and so that's like this other clue.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah. And there's beauty in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's raw, and it has energy. It has a fair bit of energy in it, even though it talks about being exhausted. There is a seduction that comes along with this stage, which is to yield to the habit of constant doubt, to think that you're always there. That's a delusion also, isn't it? You're not always there.
I'm not following. You yield to the
seduction of thinking that you're always there.
There's where?
In the lost place. I'm sorry, I was still in number one. I went backwards.
Don't do that.
That's what I have to do. And so the challenge then is to believe your heart. Believe the longing of your heart. Yeah? Not quit, not saying, it's always been like this, it's always going to be like this, and fuck it, you know. This is not that picture. This is one with the longing of the heart.
Is it possible to just wear your doubt out?
Oh, are we trying to get rid of doubt?
Well, I don't know. I don't know.
Do you want to wear your doubt out?
I'd like to try. Well, that's like everything. It's like the dog that chased the car and caught it and says, "What the hell have I done?" but I'm not sure.
Okay. So that's the question then. And that's the longing. Right? That's an expression of longing. As I hear it, is it
right? Yeah, but there are times when the doubt dissipates. It's not there.
Right, but say more about the doubt. Do you mean the it will always be like this? Because that's not a doubt. That's
no,
a dodge.
It's more like I don't even know whether this is what is this practice?
Right. Yes. Yeah.
I don't think there's a Buddha nature. I don't know where I'm going.
Uh-huh.
Everyone else seems to know what they're going, where they're going, but not Steve.
Okay, beautiful. So I guess I would say, I hope not.
Well, a dubious gift, but I'll take it.
but to think that it has to be constant is a delusion.
I got it. I got what you're saying.
And I happen to know that yours is not.
Yeah, you do know that.
So that's what you get for talking to me.
Yeah. Well, won't be making that mistake.
You're like an old married couple. I know what you're going to say.
I'll try not to say that very often. Okay.
You know that doubt is one of the classical hindrances, right?
Yeah.
And one of the three jewels.
One of the three legs to the chair.
Oh. Yeah.
Great doubt, great faith.
One of the three things you need, right? Great doubt, great faith, and great determination are considered the essentials for this practice. So
there you have it.
There you have it.
But I mean, I do read about people's testimonies. Should I be quiet?
No.
I read about people who they hit what they call the great doubt, and then the great doubt shatters.
Yes, forever and ever, amen.
Well,
right?
They didn't say that. Okay, quite a major point.
Okay. all right. Onward. But one more point, actually, but about that first window. At this point, if you're looking elsewhere for a solution, right? Mm-hmm. You think the problem is outside of you. I'm lost. Where is the ox? Where has it gotten to? Mm-hmm. Nobody's helping me. And so there is that in this picture, that feeling of helplessness. which comes along with the not intimate, right? Not intimate with anything. So you're feeling like everything is far away. Everything and everybody is far away. Okay, so for discovering the footprints, this is feeling a bit slow. I'm wondering. Okay. So there are signs. What was that line from Paul Simon? Signs and intimations. I can't remember.
Written on the subway
walls, tenement halls.
Yeah.
That's how old we are. We know these words.
The signs of the prophets are
written on the subway walls, tenement halls.
Now it's a different one. Anyway, never mind. There are signs. And so there, although you still, again, you in the beginning you're helpless, which is not skillfulness, right? There's no skillfulness involved except the suggestion that you just be lost at that moment and keep listening. But in discovering the footprints, you have somewhere to go. And there's a little bit less of that feeling of complete lack of intimacy because you now have some connection to your ox. And Joe Kobeck made this lovely statement, which is, of course, the footprints are everywhere, right? But each of us has to find them somewhere. Mm-hmm. It's not a generalized thing. We find it somewhere, and we follow it. And that may happen over and over, but there's something specific in the landscape. It's not just generalized darkness in the landscape, yeah?
I have a quick question, comment up. Because I had this very elaborate dream that came up not last night, but it's been a few nights ago.
Yeah.
And lost on this vast lake, and I'm in this little motorboat with my sister, and I'm looking at signs, and I don't know where to go, but I don't want to tell her I'm lost. So there's that part that,
right.
You know, I'm lost, and I think I recognize something, but I don't want anybody to know how confused I am.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yeah,
yeah. And I'm curious about that. Mm-hmm. With this.
Yeah. Another thing that's a point that gets brought in with that perceiving the tracks one is that the tracks are often seem to signify the scriptures and what you study. Yeah, all of the teachings that you can study. And the point is that they are just tracks, right? They are not the bull, not the ox. and the doubt, and a doubt that arises here is, will I be able to, when you first start to study and you're reading all kinds of things, you have this question, well, am I going to be able to weed out, you know, what's really true from what's not true? And that's a sort of characteristic of that particular stage. And again, it can happen later. You know, you've been studying one way and you feel that there's something else you want to learn, to know about, something you want to explore, but you wonder who's the right guide or which is the right book, you know. That comes up again and again. And you are starting to question your own thoughts. Yeah? Because the landscape is getting opened up and you have more. Yeah.
Sorry to do this, but is it possible just to question whether the thoughts are really your own?
Well, yeah.
Because that's what's been, like, showing up for me.
Yes. Where did they come from?
Well, yeah, I've always assumed they were my thoughts.
Right. But that's not your current experience. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't agree with that.
You don't agree with what?
That the thoughts are your own. I mean, you know, thoughts come up, things you've read or, you know, seen on TV or whatever, and, you don't have to take ownership. I don't think I have to.
Oh, that's what he's saying.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's saying
you
thought.
You do agree with it. Thank you.
I thought I heard that.
You said something that sounded like those are my thoughts.
No, I wonder if these thoughts.
What I'm saying is these thoughts. I notice I've always assumed they were mine, and I'm not, by mine I don't mean original. I just mean I'm the one who's thinking them.
You're the origin of them.
Yeah, and that doesn't seem quite so obvious now.
Okay. All right. In your meditation,
I pulled out what goes through one of these, you know, school shooters, and I sometimes, you know, just get into it. You know, what are they thinking? What's really going on there? And you know, those thoughts aren't mine. I mean, I certainly don't take ownership of them, but I'm curious about them.
But like the ancient Greeks, like, you don't know it comes from your own brain. You think it's somebody talking to you? Or is it the universe talking to you? Or is it your own mind? I don't know. I've lost my point. Sorry.
Like a collective consciousness.
Yeah, I guess it's what you were pointing at. If it's not your individual thought, then whose is it?
Yeah, where does it come
from? Where does it come
from? Yeah. And that pulls right along behind it. Where do we come from?
Okay.
And there are other things sort of about this stage, but I don't think that they need to come in here necessarily. So, any other observations you want to make about that, or let's go to where we see at least the rear end of the bull, of the ox.
When I first read that last word, I thought it said buns.
Oh yeah, majestic buns.
Majestic what?
You got majestic horns and majestic buns.
Buns.
Oh, buns.
So here we are. I mean, I think everybody having had experiences of this, there's not a whole lot that I would want to say here beyond, again, to think about that meeting, you know, person to person, being mutual, being a meeting, seeing and being seen, and who is seeing and who is being seen, and so that they're just seeing is already an intimacy, and already there is some skillfulness, even though it seems like an accident, but we have put ourselves in, we have kept moving, we have kept meditating, we have kept ourselves present to it. We keep coming back again and again to the opening of our awareness. And then, whack, yeah, something presents itself. And I love what Senzaki says. When one hears the voice, one can sense its source. As soon as the six senses merge, the gate is entered. Wherever one enters, one sees the head of the bowl. This unity is like salt in water, like color in dye stuff. Yeah? The slightest thing is not apart from self. So that first glimpse is a doozy sometimes. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter whether it's big or small. It's seeing with your own eyes, tasting it with your own mouth. And so that's the intimacy. And at the same time, there's the landscape, right? And it's that moment when everything shines and there's gratitude and you vow to go this way. So there begins to be some skillfulness involved, right? We begin to develop some skill, not only with relation to ourselves, but with relation to our world, out of that vow. Does that make any sense? The hazard is that, why won't it stay, right? Why can't I get it back? It was so beautiful for a minute. And then people often do give up, right? Because it won't stay.
Could you talk a little bit about, like, all of the renditions talk about that stately head, stately horns, hard to finish that painting.
Yeah.
Again, what artist could draw this likeness?
Right. Okay. So this is like, you want to tell everybody about it, and immediately you realize you're just babbling because you can't.
Wordless.
And it's like, oh, if you only had what I had. You want converts at this stage, right? And then pretty soon, again, with the development of skillfulness, you realize, no, it doesn't work like that. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't save all the people that I love who are still in the dark while I'm standing here in the light.
They don't even know I'm in the light.
And it's a stage that almost all of us go through it. It just happens.
A challenge for a painter.
And so, you know, so there is this sort of growing sense of compassion, of desire to be helpful, and our skill just isn't up to it. Because part of what that's coming out of is our own frustration that we can't make it stay still and know and figure out how to talk about it, right?
Right.
So we're trying to get people to help us by showing that we're enlightening them, and you know, it turns into a project. Yeah. So Trungpa says, at this stage, you begin to see another way of dealing with your projections. And that is joy in itself. Mm-hmm. Isn't that a nicely mm-hmm. said? So you you start to recognize your projections and realize that actually, poof, they disappear mm-hmm. without a moment's notice. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that they're not nearly as solid as you thought they were. And so there's, what's that?
That's a lovely moment.
Yeah, absolutely. and so, but so there's the seeing. So in that moment, the seeing is a little ahead of the doing, mm-hmm. right? You're seeing something, but you're not very skillful mm-hmm. yet. And the picture sure presents that. And the territory changes too, right? Now we have warm sun. We have a mild wind. The whole prospect seems a lot friendlier than it has mm-hmm. been seeming, because there is a relationship with mind. Mm-hmm. I get a little bit concerned about the your mind thing, the ox being your mind. Mm-hmm. I think it's a happier thing if we stay with mind, because look how big that sucker is, you know. Mm-hmm. And
okay, sorry. This has been bothering me ever since we came here. So if the ox is the mind,
or essential nature, just how it is.
Yeah, how can we talk about taming it?
Yeah, exactly.
It doesn't.
That's where I'm hoping to go, but I'm okay. Sorry I'm being so slow. I'm just not very good at this yet. So,
well, we're all.
We're not really reading the record. We're not reading the record. This is good.
Oh, good. So here the no bull can hide. It's right there. No hiding. Nothing is hidden. There are no secrets, right? Mm-hmm. And there is not. Nobody can describe this, because you have actually touched what's ineffable, mm-hmm. right? And nobody, I can't manage to tell anybody how huge this is. That's that massive head, those majestic horns. I just want to tell it to the world, and nobody gets it.
Not even me.
Right. Okay, is that good?
So in Europa, the Buddhism, year-long Buddhism class I took, the first semester was taming the mind, mm-hmm. and the second semester was training the mind.
So that's not for me.
Well, that's...
No, I'm not disrespecting it at all.
No, but that's just, you know, you were saying, how do you tame the mind? That's, you know, that's shamatha.
But, yeah, but what is being tamed? It doesn't seem...
Yeah, okay, so that's... So I think there's a perspective question, and I think we'll look at it.
Because it sounds... I'm sorry, it just sounds like animal training sometimes.
No. Right. Right.
Aren't we?
Feels like animal training sometimes too.
That's not my experience of it.
Okay, good. So when you train, have you trained an animal?
Yes, I have.
So who trained who?
Well, I got housebroken out of the deal.
What? Yeah, I mean, that's a joke, but it's also not a joke.
No,
it's not.
It's training is a relationship.
Yeah, I understand.
Yeah, so that's where we're going.
Okay.
And
okay.
And so what I would say is this: it's this, yes, there's mind training, and yes, it's not training like that. It's not like you're going to fix that. Mm-hmm. You're going to bring it under your control.
Right.
I've been reading a lot of Trungpa Rinpoche writings, and it's about. There is discipline involved. There is precision involved. There's a tremendous amount of determination involved, but there's no aggression mm-hmm. in this kind of what's being called mind training. Mm-hmm. And so I think when we confuse training with aggression...
Maybe that's my problem.
Then I think we're talking because... and the analogies of the rope and the whip don't help. But let's go there. So when you say in number three, they're no longer separate, right? But in number four, you're so excited, right, to be connected, and that then you're trying to control. And look how big the ox is and how tiny the little person is. And so you're trying, but you have to learn what is a relationship. What is too tight? What is too loose? Mm-hmm. Right? And that is where I think the this interesting meeting of the enlightenment part and the endarkenment part mm-hmm. comes in. Mm-hmm. So that you're full of love and desire for this hugeness that you recognize that's real, that mm-hmm. you know is you in some way. Mm-hmm. That you really wish to be not separate from.
Right.
And you keep trying to get it under control.
Right.
But at the same time, you have a life that's out of control.
Right.
And you're trying to get your life under control. And so there is a sense of finding out what is skillful for working with circumstances and really working with the vastness, because there's nothing to hold on to. That vastness does not have a ring through its nose.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah, and yet your own mind, not contained in the cerebellum or in your skull, is the meeting place, right? Is a particular expression.
Yeah, I don't want to come across as being against self-improvement.
Right, no, but you're saying mm-hmm. What does it mean to be training the mind?
Right.
Yeah, and so to me, it's this meeting place of the vastness, which is mind, is your mind, mm-hmm. and the particulars, which are your mind, with your own karma and everything else that comes mm-hmm. with it, mm-hmm. and learning to have, what does it mean for those to be in intimate companionship? There is some skill involved. And the skills of meditation, study, service, ritual, mm-hmm. companionship, relationship, those are to my understanding, the field in which we now begin to get some skillfulness in the being in relationship with this vast mind, with our particular mind, which is what we've got, right? And which is the only particular mind the vastness has mm-hmm. in this spot, right? So it's a relationship that must happen in order for anything good to go on. And we're all kind of clumsy at it in the beginning. You know the story about Bodhidharma just going, I don't know, and leaving, you know, and going off to sit for 9 years in front of a wall. You know, I love when Joan points out, he was being the vastness, and it wasn't very skillful. Mm-hmm. Because the vastness is not big on skill. Mm-hmm. Because from the perspective of the vastness, there's nothing that needs to be done. Mm-hmm. But from the perspective of your mind, which is just a piece of that vastness, there is stuff to be done.
I can see that.
Does that help at all?
It helps me.
Do you see part of this too, though, is maybe I just see it, but I'm not disagreeing at all, but part of it to me is the ego. And when we encounter the vastness, we tend to want to have the vastness fit what we like.
Right.
I mean, I hear it myself too, is that when Pen Mr. Jones says something that I agree with, I go, hell yeah.
Right.
I, da, da, da. But when she says, well, like Pen Mr. Jones, any writer,
okay. Yeah.
pick anybody, or the Buddha. And And when it says when something that's challenging to what I like to do and who I am, right. I disregard it and try to find a way to rationalize it. I'm holding this rope like this, exactly. Right? I want to make this all fit Regan Arntzen's plan about how this world exactly. should work. And I don't like it when it's not, and this thing's tough. And so yeah. when you kind of let it, when you find out what the vastness is, it I mean, not does the, I don't know if the bull or the ox stops pulling so much as maybe you stop trying to control it so much.
And maybe some of each.
Yeah.
it's a relationship. Yeah. And, you know, Trungpa keeps using this word workability, finding out that the situation is workable. To me, this is like that. It's that when we're training the mind, what we're really doing is discovering how the situations are workable. And our mind then becomes more workable. So that's the skillfulness part of it.
And what was it that used the dance analogy, or did I dream that?
No, it was there.
Seems like that was spoken.
It was from Cage.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Okay. Eons ago this morning.
Yeah.
A lifetime ago.
Yeah. And so the so here about the territory, let's just touch on the territory for this one, for catching the bull. Yeah. now you're in the wild places, right? You're up on a high plateau, far above the cloud mists, or in the ravine. I mean, you're in the wilds on this one, but it's like the high wilds, and so. It's so, which takes courage and perseverance, and heart. So here, I don't even know where this note came from, but generosity and discipline were not enough. You need skillful means and to see things as they are. Otherwise, we can't. Oh, it's Trungpa. Otherwise, we can't transcend our aggression. We need complete commitment to the Bodhisattva path, and we get that as we develop patience and energy. That's just what we were just talking about.
Could you read that again, please?
Yeah. Generosity and discipline were not enough. We need skillful means and to see things as they are. Otherwise, so, you know, he's trying to discipline. You know, you're trying to discipline your mind, and it's not enough. So that's a nice way of saying it. It's not that it's a bad thing to do, but it's not enough. You need some skillful means, and that the ox will teach you. Otherwise, we can't transcend our aggression. That fundamentally, we have a lot of habits of aggression against our own minds and against big mind, right? We, as you were saying, Regan, we would like it to conform to our opinion, to our desires. Yeah. And it won't do it. So we need complete commitment to the Bodhisattva path, and this is coming right back to the Dhyan Sutra, right? What will power us while we're developing the skills, the skillful means, is our commitment not to ourselves, right? Because that won't do it. If we're just going to sit there and whine, it won't behave, right? We won't get skillful means without being powered by that Bodhisattva vow. And there's a waka, a verse that says, thinking, at last my mind, the ox, don't let go. Just this is the real fetter. So, all right. So if you look at the pictures, all of them for five, taming the bull, you're really in much tamer looking territory, aren't you?
Yeah.
It's a road. You're on a road. And And there's, and this one just looks like it takes years, right? This one is like little bit by little bit by little bit by little bit, you learn each other. Mm-hmm. You learn the skillful means, and you're taught by your, by the vastness as well as by the road, mm-hmm. right? And your companions. You're getting to know yourself and mind and the vastness, which seems odd, but so here arrogance can be a problem. But there's this lovely quote that says, "Pray as you can, not as you can't." As words of advice for this stage. Pray as you can, not as you can't. You know, when you're always sort of trying to lean towards that thing that you can't quite do, it might be better to do the thing that you can do. Sometimes it'll be clear, sometimes it won't be. Lurie says, at every step of the way, every year of my practice, I'd say to myself, this is it, I've got it. And then 2 weeks later, now this is really it. Now I've got it. And so that's sort of a characteristic of this stage where we just are practicing and we just keep going. Learning to maintain our center and our concentration, and we learn to do it in harder and harder circumstances. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so we need that ox to be pulling off to the side. Yeah. So Lurie calls this a repeated movement from realization to actualization. And to extract ourselves from the mud-filled spiritual swamps is especially difficult. Okay, but we begin to be able to trust ourselves and we get used to and friendly with the spiritual plateau. This is a flat road, and you can tell it just goes on. And so that's useful advice, I think, too, is don't be freaked out by your plateaus. You know, it's just that's part of it. That it's the onward work of gaining wisdom and compassion, but it gets more and more intimate. That you can feel the intimacy in the pictures on this one, can't you? They're much closer together. Mm-hmm. And you know that's true, that there's this you get much more familiar with the ins and outs, that sometimes you're going to drop into the vastness and sometimes you're going to be grappling with the particular. On to number 6. Are you guys getting worn out with this? You're okay with, you're still hanging in there?
Can I just say one quick thing about naturally gentle?
Well, yeah.
Well, this is, and I swear this is my last fly fishing story, but probably not true. But when you, it is a lie. But when you fly fish, inevitably the wind comes up and your line gets tangled, and it's really hard not to get really mad.
Right.
Right. Because you're going, there's a fish right there, and now I can't get after it. But the nature, if the line didn't do that, it couldn't do what it's supposed to do either. Right. Uh-huh. You have to take it with the same time, and you do become more gentle. You just go, well, that's what the line does. And if I ever want to fish and catch that fish, I have to allow it to also get tangled, and I don't have to get quite so upset and caught in that. So that's my little Zen help that I've had on the fishing deals. It's the nature to do it, right? And so
right.
I'm kind of gentle.
And that's what the mind does. And if it didn't do that, it also couldn't do this. Yeah. Right. Beautiful.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. All right, writing. Struggle's over. And
nothing about the environment.
Except that you're on your way home and it's evening. Mm-hmm. Oh, it, yeah. Mm. Yeah, not so much. And the, but the landscape is very open in is it in this picture too? Mm-hmm. Yeah, you get, there's space in the distance, right? And you're, it looks like it's downhill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So those are a few things about the environment. Yeah,
there's
no effort. You're actually strolling downhill, and there's in this picture as well. It's very spacious. You see the distant mountains off there, and the. And there is that sense that it's really the first time that I think it's in here of I could be helpful to somebody, right? Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's by chance, it'll seem like it's by chance, right? It's just if somebody hears this tune, they'll join me. Mm-hmm. And it's not that I'm preaching to them. They're just going to like the music. Harada Roshi says, at this stage, we face everything without fear. We're in society, but when we're pushed, we move back. When we're pulled, we move forward. Mm-hmm. So there's that skillful means part, mm-hmm. right? And so you've got spaciousness around you. You're not afraid. You're not trying to accomplish anything. And so you're able to... So the endarkening part is you're more able to be flexible in your actual daily interactions. So if you're going to try to persuade somebody, you're not going to try to persuade them. But if you just play your music, that'll help. It's kind of the idea there. It's lighter. There's more joy. But there's a trap here, which is that it's so comfortable, right? Mm-hmm. And so the wisdom of the elders says, go by the motto, practice another 30 years. Because it's like, oh, I'm done here, right? This mm-hmm. is comfy. I'm no longer so uncomfortable. I must be done. You know? That's the trap. Which one of the teachers calls creating reality patterns. You might package into dharma, into dogma. I just want to package this. Yeah. Okay. Onward. Mm-hmm. Oh, but there's a little echo of Hakuin, with thought that is no thought, right? With thought that is no thought, singing and dancing are the voice of the way. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the flute. Mm. Okay. Now we're at 7. Home. Everybody gets to rest. And so at home sort of means you're at home everywhere, right? It's not just you have come home and you'll just stay there. It's that you're at home. And so it's that linji, right? If wherever you are, you take the role of host. Then wherever you are, that will be a true place. It's that kind of at-homeness. Life is ordinary and beautiful. You forget the self. And from this place, oh, there's another one. the true Dharma has no fixed shape, right? So there's also Linji's two person of no rank, yeah, continually coming and going through the gates of your face. And there is like the pattern, so no shape like the patterns of water flowing. The birds fly in the sky without a path, and the fish swim through the water without any traces. That kind of at-homeness. You're at ease with yourself. And then we get the Dharmakaya picture. Where it all, where there is no thing. And the hazard, of course, is getting stuck there, which is known as dead person breathing.
Is that what I was reading about, or listening to, I guess, several years ago, when I used to listen to Buddhist podcasts, and they're talking about Buddhist dark night of the soul, where you just don't feel anything anymore, and you need, like, special help?
Actually, this is not so much that. This tends to be pretty blissful.
Okay, and I thought so, but it occurred to me. Sorry.
But yeah, we can come back to that.
Okay, that came up when you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for bringing that in. We'll come back to it. I don't think I have much to say about that. Trungpa, there's a quote from Trungpa, this is the perfection of non-watching. And I thought that's kind of lovely, because sometimes people think that mind is awareness and that you are the one who is aware, right? Mm-hmm. And in here there is no one who is aware.
Mm-hmm.
Good. Should we move on?
Can I just ask?
Yeah.
This heaven is so vast, no message can stain it. And I have no idea what that's saying.
Okay, where did that come from, right there?
On 8. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah. Okay, great. I think that next, how may a snowflake exist in a raging fire, is kind of the response to that question. And so it's to say that there is nothing that isn't already included in this vastness. And so nothing could be considered a stain. Nothing is going to, it's like saying clouds don't obscure the sky. There's sky, plenty of room for clouds. They're not blocking anything. I think it's that. Does that make sense?
It does, yes.
Okay. Because vast is vast, limit, completely boundless. Yeah. So there's nothing that isn't included. And so reaching the source. So if the last one is Dharmakaya, the absoluteness of the vastness, that then here we are in the territory of Sambhogakaya, coming back into the realm of embodiment. So out of emptiness appears that which is. Yeah, mm-hmm. The 10,000 things rise and disappear. It's the from the beginning, there has been nothing but purity. Listening to Dharma talks by the stones. Yeah. Stones and clouds are your teachers. There's no fear. As in the Heart Sutra. no traces of the Dharma way on the original mountain. The Waka says, this is a poem. There are no traces of the Dharma way on the original mountain. The pines are green, the flowers glint with dew. Or another koan, Daijo was asked, what is eternal life? He replied, the mountain flowers bloom like a rich brocade. The river's water flows like deep indigo. So it's the bliss body. It's enjoying. This is actually in real life enjoying the vastness. So this is not dead person breathing. Yeah, okay. This is full of life. And so if you look at the landscape, then there's that, right? It's a landscape that's just juicy, full of life, red flowers blooming. And it can be that because you're not scared of the relationships, right? You're not scared to be alive, to be a human being alive. So even though you're not, there's not a person there, that doesn't mean this has nothing to do with relationship. Oak tree in the garden. And then the last one, unless somebody wants to say anything more about that. But there's that sense of ease in simply being alive. Yeah. Comfort in the body. And the landscape is very peaceful. And then we're heading back into town. And that ease, I'm sorry, in nine is also really expressed by that, you know, in one's true home, unconcerned with and without. And so then back in the world, the Nirmanakaya, the fully embodied Buddha. And there's your moon in all of the puddles, right? Trungpa says, the moon has no desire to reflect, but that is its nature. You destroy whatever needs to be destroyed. You subdue whatever needs to be subdued, and you care for what needs your care. And I love the Waka, the poem for this one too. Hands extended, feet in the sky. On a dead branch, a bird perches. And then Lurie has a nice caution, a nice cautionary word, lest you think this is like, okay, done. Yeah, made it. Lurie says, completing formal training doesn't mean we are not aware of ourselves anymore or that we stop working on ourselves. It just means that a fundamental change in how we appreciate the self and reality has occurred. And we're able to actualize that view in our lives. Still, Zazen continues.
That's a question. In this picture, yeah. He's so large and dominates the whole thing. Is that intentional?
Oh, yeah, nice. Yeah, yeah. Yes, there's not too much landscape, is there? It's town. You're back in town. Yeah. And actually, the other things that are written about this say, you know, that he's completely unremarkable. Nobody notices him at all, right? the thing about being so large is a reference to not needing anything, and to Maitreya, right?
Okay.
Who comes into the world with candy and flowers and sits in the middle of the marketplace. In one story, that's the one who sits in the middle of the marketplace, opens his bag, spreads everything out, and holds something up and says, "What's this? What's this? What's this?" So, large, well satisfied, okay. I think is the idea there. Does anybody have a different perspective they'd like to bring in on that one? Carries the staff of his purpose and the wine jug of his true desire. I kind of love that.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you're still practicing, right? Mm-hmm. And forever. And you're the wine, the sweet wine of your bodhicitta is nourishing you. Yeah. And Walt Whitman, henceforth I will go celebrate anything I see or am and sing and laugh and deny nothing. That was his comment. Yeah, Joko Beck's comment is, very few are really willing to stick with this, to find that still point. But for those who practice steadily in their daily life, there will be more and more a taste of the joy in a relationship in which no self meets no self. That's kind of sweet, isn't it? That this is the ongoing development of intimacy and skillful means. Yeah. Well, thank you for tolerating that long walk here. We only have 10 more minutes, so we should sit for a little bit.